From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Whitmer bans flavored e-cigarettes to keep kids from vaping.
Almost all nicotine addiction is established in the teenage years. And so anything we can do to prevent kids from being exposed to nicotine is a good thing.
She wants basically this order to be enshrined in law or adopted as a legitimate rule that can be enforced by state agencies.
The CEO of Consumers Energy has a message to customers. Please use less energy.
And our goal here is to eliminate the need to build three new power plants by simply eliminating energy waste all across the state.
And the Bay City school teacher who went over Niagara Falls and lived.
I love her quote. I would sooner walk in the mouth of a cannon knowing it's going to blow me to pieces than make another trip over the falls.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we talk with the CEO of Consumers Energy about the new campaign to get customers to use less energy. How much of it is for climate change and how much is for the bottom line? We learn more later in the hour. But first, Governor Whitmer today made Michigan the first state to ban flavored e-cigarettes. The governor said she invoked the emergency rule after the state's chief medical executive declared young people using e-cigarettes was a public health emergency. The ban takes effect immediately. It applies to online and retail sales of flavored vaping products, although businesses do have 30 days to comply. Richard Meek is with the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research, and he's been researching the issue of teens and vaping. Richard, what are your thoughts on this ban?
Well, three thoughts, really. I think it's very bold. So kudos to Governor Whitmer for jumping right in there. I think it's also very strategic. So if you look at what we know about the literature, I think it makes a lot of sense. And third, I think it's really exciting. As an academic, I really want to see what's going to happen. I'm on the edge of my seat.
So let's talk about research. Does research support the governor's position that the ban is about keeping young people safe and that flavored vaping products are tied to increased use among young people?
Well, I will say this, that there's right now, and the most popular brand of vaping device is called Juul, J-U-U-L, and they have about eight flavors. And two of them are tobacco, Virginia tobacco and classic tobacco. And if you look at the current research out there, maybe about 1% of youth use those flavors. They don't like those flavors. You've never heard of tobacco-flavored ice cream, have you? I mean, it's a terrible flavor, right? Nobody wants that. But what the kids do like are the fruity flavors, the mango flavors, the mint flavors, those types of flavors. And so it follows that if you banned those flavors, that kids would be much less interested in vaping in the first place.
Do we know, beyond shadow of a doubt, that because those flavors are there, we are seeing more kids vaping? Does it work back that way?
Well, vaping's only been around for like 3 or 4 years, so we don't really know at this point. And in fact, this policy will actually inform that. We'll know that if it's effective and if the state of Michigan is successful in banning some of these flavors, then we'll see if teen vaping goes down in Michigan.
Now, we've certainly heard a flurry of reports throughout the country of lung disease that could be linked to vaping. Are you aware of any research conclusively linking vaping with that lung disease, or is it more it's a suspected link?
I think it's a great medical mystery at this point, right? Like you say, there does seem to be a lot of links between kids who just vaped and later lung disease, but as of yet, there is no definitive link. I think we need some toxicological studies and some not randomized controlled studies. You can't do that, can you? You can't see what happens, but more observational studies to look at more in depth at that.
But we do have, without a doubt, studies have shown that tobacco cigarettes, the traditional cigarettes, are linked to a wide range of health problems. So what would you say to critics who say, why are we cracking down on flavored e-cigarettes when regular tobacco cigarettes are legal and they're available?
Well, that's a good point. There's really two camps in the public health field, and they're really diametrically opposed. And so one camp thinks that vaping is a good thing, right? And these are primarily public health people who focus on adults. And it could very well be the case that vaping will help these adults quit smoking. And as you say, the dangers of smoking are well known, and it's really quite extraordinary if you look at some of the statistics. 1 in 5 deaths right now in the United States are tobacco-related. Half of regular smokers every year try to quit, or hardly any of them ever succeed in quitting. So that's a real problem, smoking right now. And so if there's anything out there that can help people quit, such as perhaps vaping, then that seems like a good thing that we should promote. So that's one camp that sees vaping as a good thing. The other camp primarily focuses on adolescents. And what we find there has been an exponential increase in vaping in just the last few years. So the most current data as of 2018 showed that among U.S. 12th graders, 1 in 5 has vaped nicotine in the past 30 days. I mean, that's quite remarkable, right? In just a few years, the prevalence has grown to such an amount, to such a high level. And the thing is about nicotine is that it's highly addictive. Nobody doubts that anymore. For a while, there were people trying to say it's not addictive, but clearly it's a very addictive substance. And just as an example, we at MTF, we asked 12th graders who are smoking cigarettes, we asked them, do you think you'll be smoking 5 years from now? And then of those who are smoking, about 90% say, no, I won't be smoking 5 years from now. But then we follow them up 5 years later, and we find that 90% are still smoking. So addiction is something that kind of sneaks up on you, right? So this camp that focuses on adolescents, they realize the dangers of nicotine addiction. Almost all nicotine addiction is established in the teenage years. And so anything we can do to prevent kids from being exposed to nicotine is a good thing. So a policy like this, which, by the way, I want to emphasize, it doesn't ban vaping or e-cigarettes. It just bans flavors, right? And so I think it's very strategic in a way that the devices are still out there for adults. If they want to try to quit smoking using vaping, they can. They can use unflavored vaping devices or maybe tobacco-flavored. I don't know what the policy is going to be at this point. So that potential is still there for them. But what the ban does is that it prohibits the flavoring of e-cigarettes and vaping, which kids find very attractive.
Do you think Michigan's on a forefront of a national wave toward banning these flavored vaping products?
Well, San Francisco has done so already. I know Los Angeles is considering it. Michigan is the first state, and I think it's on the vanguard, and that's why I'm really excited. I could very easily see other states following suit, if not the nation, in the coming years.
Richard Miek with the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research. He has been researching the issue of young people and vaping. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So who stands to lose with this ban? Well, most directly, the businesses that sell vaping products. Stateside's Tad Davis spoke to Jacques Hall, who owns Ace Vapes in Ypsilanti. He says beyond his business, vaping saved his life.
That's the sound of a person being cigarette-free since 2017. I haven't picked up a cigarette, haven't wanted a cigarette, smoking stinks, yuck, don't want it at all. This alternative helped save my life, my lungs, and just my life overall, you know. So I want to be here on this earth as long as I can. So that's why I vape.
And Jacques Hall says it's not just his health that this ban will affect.
This will affect my business greatly because a lot of this stuff on here and what you see, I have a lot of flavored e-juice in here. And that would take away 90 to 99% of the juice and stock that I have on my shelves. So that's going to hurt big time. It's really going to put me out of business in a minute.
That was Jacques Hall, owner of Ace Vapes in Ypsilanti. Now let's look at the pushback and politics of the new ban. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here with us. So just to recap, this flavored e-cigarette ban takes effect immediately, both online and retail. Businesses have 30 days to comply. How long does the ban last?
The ban lasts for 6 months, 180 days to be exact, but the governor can renew it for another 180 days, but by then, someone's got to do something to make this permanent, otherwise it expires.
Okay, so what does she want from the legislature?
She wants basically this order to be enshrined in law or adopted as a legitimate rule that can be enforced by state agencies.
All right, well, we know the Food and Drug Administration has already been pointing to a surge in vaping among middle and high school students. It has proposed restricting sales on many flavored e-cigarettes. San Francisco has banned all e-cigarettes that's starting early next year. So the industry clearly is marshaling its response. What is it saying about Governor Whitmer's action?
Well, there are municipal bans in effect in some places around the country, but statewide bans have not held up yet. So Michigan would be the first state to have a statewide ban. And so we are seeing this is already happening, that the vaping industry is getting ready to lobby legislators to say, don't allow this to become a permanent rule. Don't adopt a law saying that this will take effect. And their argument is that vaping is a safer, if not safe, alternative to smoking. And so what you're going to be doing is you're going to be driving people who use, and the industry term is combustibles, back to lighting a cigarette and smoking rather than vaping, a quote unquote safer form of smoking and nicotine use.
Well, as we just heard from U of M's Richard Miek, his point is they're not taking e-cigarettes and vaping away, and that it's the young people that like the fruit flavored and the fun flavored. Right. Adults are going for tobacco, so they're not taking that away from adults.
That's right. That's what they're saying. But there are, and this is part of this rule, is that there are limitations on the marketing of e-cigarettes, especially when it comes to marketing the flavors or marketing them as a safe alternative to nicotine, to smoking.
So what are the potential politics that could play out here?
Well, look, we know that money plays a big part. And so the industry is going to be putting money into campaign spending for people, you know, who will go with them on this. There's going to be money putting into lobbying that the industry already has a lobbyist in Lansing. And so there's that. And also there will be among especially, you know, that group that we've come to call Tea Party Republicans, that this is going to be a matter of, that they're going to argue that this is a matter of personal choice and not something that the government should be stepping in and imposing, especially when it comes to choices made by adults.
So stay tuned.
This is going to be a wild one.
Rick Pluta, as always, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Still to come, school's main focus is on getting kids college and career ready. But what about kids who need a little more time to figure out what they want to do in life? After the break, we talk about how to support those students. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, it's Wednesday, which means it's time to dig into our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
As students and teachers plunge into a new school year, let us stop now to remember a Bay City teacher who took a different sort of plunge right over Niagara Falls. And Annie Edson Taylor was able to tell the story of her daredevil feat. Rachel Clark of the Michigan History Center is here with us now. Rachel, when did Annie Edson Taylor climb in her barrel and go over Niagara Falls? It was the Canadian Horseshoe Falls, right?
It was. She went over the Canadian Horseshoe Falls October 24th, 1901, which happened to be her birthday.
Oh, boy. And we are not talking about some youngster, are we, right? This was her 63rd birthday?
It was. She tended to fib about her age, some accounts by up to about 20 years, but this was her 63rd birthday that she went over the falls.
All right, before we get further into Annie's feat, making her the first recorded person to go over the mighty falls and survive, let's talk about Niagara Falls, especially at that start of the 20th century. Certainly was a big headache once upon a time for travelers on the Great Lakes, right, until the Erie Canal?
Yes. Prior to 1805, travel between Lakes Ontario and Erie required a very long portage. So once the Erie Canal was open, it made it possible to avoid the falls if you wanted.
Okay, so that is out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
When we're looking at this time at the beginning of the 20th century, was Niagara Falls the tourist attraction that it is today?
It actually was. In the early 19th century, the railroad allowed people to visit the falls on holiday. So by the mid-1800s, people do spend time there. And then in 1859, for whatever reason, you start getting people who are tightrope walking across parts of the river and near the falls, not quite over the falls. But you start to get those types of activities going on, and that just increases people's want and need to go see the falls. So by 1900, it is a tourist attraction.
So people had been tightrope walking. What about this idea of, let's see if we can go over the falls and live to tell about it? What led to that? And particularly, why did a 63-year-old teacher from Bay City decide, yep, that's for me?
So by 1900, Annie Taylor, she was no longer working, and she was having a hard time making ends meet. She was in Bay City still at that time and reading newspaper accounts of the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York, and was reading about how no one had ever gone over the falls. People are tightrope walking over it, but no one had ever actually gone over the falls. And for whatever reason, she decided she wanted to do that. And I can say, I taught middle school for 11 years, and never once did I think, I've got an idea. I'm going to go hop on a barrel and go over Niagara Falls. So I'm not sure exactly why she thought it was a good idea.
Wow. And going into a barrel, what do we know about the barrel she used? And did she wear any kind of protective clothing?
She designed the barrel. It was essentially a beer barrel, wooden, 4 foot tall, made of oak and iron. She padded it with a mattress, and she didn't wear any protective clothing. She anchored it down with an anvil or something heavy in the bottom of it. And she brought her lucky pillow with her. So she really, you know, you read stories about people since that have gone over the falls in these very highly engineered, highly structured devices, still a lot of barrel-shaped things.
Yeah.
But she really didn't have a lot with her, just a pillow.
A pillow, her lucky pillow. So tell us about the day. Tell us about the day of the drop on October 24th, 1901. What happened?
So they had to delay the drop a couple days because of weather. 2 days prior to her drop, she actually sent a cat over to test the barrel, which makes my heart hurt.
Oh, my heart just hurt, too. Oh.
They made it appear the cat survived. I don't know if the cat survived. There's a photo of her with the barrel and a cat, but I don't know if the cat actually survived. So there had been some hype up to this point. And so by the time the day rolled around, she hopped in the barrel and had a crew row her out into the middle of the river, about a mile up. And they pumped the barrel full of air with bike pumps, essentially, and sealed it up and sent her on her way.
Sent her on her way. And I think I remember hearing when she went over the falls, she actually got stuck behind that curtain of water. Mm-hmm. And I know I've spent my lifetime visiting the Horseshoe Falls. Mm-hmm. And when you go down to the Table Rock down there and go under and stand and watch that curtain and look at them hitting the rocks below, it is just awe-inspiring.
It is. It's loud and it's so powerful. And she did get stuck behind the falls for a time. But then the force of the water popped the barrel back out, and a signal went out to a crew to go fish her out of the river.
And how was she after this stunt?
She was fine, believe it or not. She had a cut on her head, and she was pretty dazed. She was in shock, and they pulled her out. But overall, she was perfectly fine.
What did she have to say about her experience?
I love her quote. So she said, "I would sooner walk in the mouth of a cannon knowing it's going to blow me to pieces than make another trip over the falls." So she did not want to do it again. And she actually suggested nobody else do it. She didn't enjoy it by any means. So.
Well, you just stop. And I looked it up just to kind of remind myself that the Horseshoe Falls is the most powerful waterfall in North America. That vertical drop is 160 feet. She's in a beer barrel with her lucky pillow and a mattress. How did she not get killed?
I have no idea. Luck. As I said, if you look at the engineering of other devices that have gone over the falls successfully with people in them, they're no joke. Most of them are pretty well engineered. At the very least, people wear helmets. I don't know. She just was the luckiest person at that time because there's no real reason for her to have survived that.
So what about the rest of her life? And more importantly, did she manage to make any money from this stunt? Because that was the reason she did it.
No, she didn't make any money, really. Her thinking was she would go on tour, talk of her adventures, and make money. She put together a brochure of her life, but she just never really made it. She didn't have that sort of stage personality. I think people thought of her as a little silly. The brochure she put together seemed a litany of tall tales about her life. And so people just really didn't have any interest in hearing her. And then by 1911, a British gentleman went over the falls successfully, and he actually broke multiple bones and spent months in recovery. And he went on tour, and people were far more interested in hearing his story. So she ended up not making any money and dying in poverty.
Oh,
yeah. So she died in poverty in 1921 in Lockport, New York.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm sure she felt just very, very ill-used by fate that this British guy came and basically stole her thunder and made money. Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, with the story of Bay City teacher Annie Edson Taylor, the first person in recorded history to go over Niagara Falls and live. And just think, the next time anybody goes to that Canadian side and you stand right there seeing that water pouring over the edge of the Horseshoe Falls, think of what that must have been like. Wow. Hey, thanks, Rachel.
Thank you very much. And a shout out to all the teachers back in the classroom.
When I say college freshman, what image comes to mind? Well, probably an 18-year-old living in a dorm, partying on the weekends. But that picture doesn't reflect the reality of student demographics in higher education today. Around 3/4 of the undergraduates enrolled at colleges and universities meet at least one criteria of a non-traditional student. So let's talk about what it means for how we prepare kids for life after high school. As we welcome Matinga Ragatz, education consultant, stateside commentator, here with us via Skype. Matinga, let's start by defining it. What exactly makes someone a non-traditional student?
Well, a non-traditional student is a student that didn't just go directly from high school to college. So there are so many life events that happen between, for 18-year-olds or 17-year-olds between high school and college, that a lot of people take the time maybe to get a job, maybe to have a baby, maybe to move or to volunteer and then decide to go to college. So non-traditional students are people maybe in their 20s or older, and nowadays is even people in their 50s and older.
All right, so we have this very big focus and push in Michigan schools on getting kids, I'm going to use the air quotes here because we hear this phrase, college and career ready before they leave high school. So what do you think is missing in that prep for the kids who just might not be ready to make that decision when they're 17 or 18?
It's a very simple concept. These kids just need time to allow them to get some life experience before they spend tens of thousands of dollars trying to find themselves on a college campus. Time to process. That's all these kids need.
You talked to a few young people who took an untraditional route to higher education. One of them is Tim Yang, and here's what he had to say about why he thinks taking some time between high school and college can be a good thing.
I've met a lot of people who did rush into college, and they kind of crashed and burned, or by the end of graduation, they were just very disillusioned, and they ended up not getting a job in their majors or anything. So
Matinga, kind of recap what he said and expand on that for us. What are some of the downsides of jumping right into a college or career plan after you walk the stage and graduate from high school?
That, you know, there's so many risks in doing that, because like what Tim just said, it was such a packed statement. Kids come out of high school sometimes really burnt out. They're done with school, they're done with college, but then they have that pressure of having to go into further education. And so in the college experience, especially since we know that almost 50% of kids do not, 50% of freshmen do not graduate on time in college. Since we know that, it's a very, very big risk to go ahead and apply for college, pay these incredible bills, and then drop out and have those low-paying jobs. And now you're in debt on top of that.
Mm. So what do students get out of going to college after they get, you know, that some time gaining life experience?
Well, I think, you know, you gain a lot of focus and self-reflection. And in talking to a lot of the kids, a lot of students who have had this alternative route, they just have so much time to reflect and really get to know themselves and get to know what they want. And so when they're going into a college experience at an older age, they have a focus. They understand the script, and they also understand the seriousness of the college investment. And like if they've paid rent, if they've gone to work, if they're supporting a family, they understand that investment. They have a tougher skin. You know, life kind of has a way to show you different perspectives when you're allowed to have it. And they are more likely to kind of pick more specified paths than just the general, oh, I'm going to be a doctor or I'm going to be a lawyer type of professions. So they have better time management as well. So they, it's you know, they get a chance to really try out who they are before they get to college.
Let's talk a bit about risk, Matinga, because people without post-secondary education, mm-hmm. we know they earn some of the lowest wages in the country. There's high unemployment. Is there a risk that if you give kids that third option beyond college and career ready, that it could lead them to just kind of ending up in that low wage, low opportunity slot in those kind of jobs?
Yes and no. Hmm. Yes, because, you know, if you're a junior or senior and you really do not know where you want to go, and if you do not have a plan, then you're more likely to end up just kind of either adopting somebody else's plan or in those low jobs. But if you are a junior or a senior who does not know what to do, and you make a plan, you sit down with a college, with a high school counselor or a teacher or your parents, and you make a plan to what you're going to do after high school, you're more likely to focus on the experiences that will make you a better college student. Because these days you can do things like work on your portfolio, you can have an internship, and there's a lot of online online platforms that allow you to explore different ideas. Maybe you want to go into the music production. Maybe you want to go into, you know, business management, et cetera. There are many, many things that you can do before you make a decision as to what you want to do in college.
I know. Just a quick question about the social impact of this. Is there any stigma in being the kid who is not, you know, going off to college and moving away from home after graduation?
Yes, there is. And in fact, in talking to some of the kids that agreed to talk to me for this particular segment, it's traumatic. It's very embarrassing to meet your friends who have that rich college experience and be able to, and having to admit that you're just working at the local pizza shop. And again, because the schools sell the narrative that college and career ready looks a certain way, when kids take paths that are outside of that, it makes them look like they're somehow, you know, losers, or they're doomed losers. That's what one of the students said.
Hmm. So if you're mom or dad and you're mm-hmm. watching your youngster kind of decide they are not ready to go to college, what should parents say or do to kind of guide their youngster through this spell?
Oh, my goodness. I need them to pause because this is really hard. I know this because I am one of these parents. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an educator, yet I've had children who struggled through school. So all I can tell them is to say, you know, you have to be supportive and you have to stop living vicariously through your kids. You know, parents, we feel like somehow our students' academic success is a reflection on us. And especially being an immigrant parent, where sometimes having the students have a big, like your student get a big job, go to a big school, is more important than having a child that has a fulfilling life. So parents need to just, you know, support their child in exploring their options. And they can, you know, here's what I tell the parents to say. I would say, and when somebody asks you, hey, what's your senior doing this year? Where are they going to school? What schools have they visited? I'd say to them, you know, hey, there are so many wonderful opportunities, exciting opportunities these days. My kid, he's exploring his options. So that's free.
There you go. And how can high schools prepare students who are don't end up in an immediate post-secondary path?
Well, I think high schools should spend a lot more time making sure that the students have, for example, they can turn true life experiences into assignments that lead to credit. they can focus on raising kids with coping skills, and they can stop the narrative that somehow if you're not interested in going to college right away, you're somehow damaged, because we know that some of the founders of today's most exciting companies were dropouts. School did not happen for them. So employers these days are starting to understand that the word is out. You know, according to this Forbes magazine article, dismissing candidates without college degrees actually limits your competitive edge. So a lot of the most creative people whose schools did not work for them are now founders and CEOs of some of the best companies. You're talking your Mark Zuckerbergs and Bill Gates and your Steve Jobs, and not even talking about those big guys. Kids who are opening the best restaurants in our neighborhoods, clothing designers, popular food trucks, YouTube influencers. There are 16-year-olds making $40,000 without high school, without a college experience. So there are many, many options. And knowing that, I think high schools could just kind of open up and try to bring some of these experiences, turning them into credit, so the kids can move on to the next level of their life.
Michigan Radio's education consultant, Matinga Ragatz. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up next, the CEO of Consumers Energy is trying to get her clients to use less of the product she sells, energy.
And our goal here is to eliminate the need to build 3 new power plants by simply eliminating energy waste all across the state.
That is next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How often is it that you hear the head of a company ask customers to use less of its product? Well, the CEO of Consumers Energy is doing exactly that, calling on business and residential customers to use less energy in the war on climate change. Patty Poppe is CEO of Consumers Energy. Patty, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, it's such a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Patty, you've been touring the state. You've got this new campaign to get business and residential customers to use less energy. What is your message in your tour?
You know, we've got a great plan for Michigan's energy future. At Consumers Energy, we are cleaning up our energy supply by retiring our coal plants and replacing them with exclusively new renewable energy. But we have a role for all Michiganders to play to reduce energy waste so we can both use cleaner energy, but to use it smarter.
Okay, so let's start with business customers. What are you calling on business customers to do?
We want to help business customers actually put more money into their business and less into their energy bills. So we've got energy products that we can work with them to reduce their energy usage. For example, LED lighting or customized solutions around the kinds of motors that they use in their processes, or to help them just simply with a smart thermostat use their air conditioning more efficiently and eliminate energy waste entirely.
Let's talk about residential customers. What's your call to them?
We are especially excited about doing home energy audits with our energy customers to assess where they are losing energy from their home. And a lot of times just a smart thermostat's enough, but sometimes new insulation or new lighting might be ways that they can eliminate energy waste. And our goal here, Cynthia, is to eliminate the need to build 3 new power plants by simply eliminating energy waste all across the state.
So you're offering free home energy audits, and so people can have someone into their homes to give them an idea.
That's right.
Do you expect these asks to change as the years go by, as you meet your goals or not, Patty?
What I've learned from my lean operating experience early in automotive and now in the utility space, seems like there's always waste to be eliminated, not to be more uncomfortable. Lean doesn't mean we go without. It means we're strong and we don't have waste. And in my experience, there seems to be unlimited opportunities to eliminate that waste in all number of areas.
What group do you think will kind of give you the biggest bang for the buck in all of this that holds the greatest potential for reducing energy use, the business customers or residential?
Well, residential air conditioning, specifically in Michigan, almost doubles our energy demand. So if we can optimize, and we can with technology today, optimize heating and cooling in people's homes so that we don't drive that spike up in demand and have to build a great big system to serve that demand. We think there's the greatest opportunity with residential customers. However, our business customers have the most to gain in straight dollars and cents. We can help them too. So I do think there's probably mutual benefit for both.
Patty, it is kind of rare to hear the CEO of a company out there on the hustings encouraging customers, hey, use less of its product. Why are you doing this?
I get that question a lot, Cynthia. You know, we're here for the long haul. This is a long game. We've been in this business 130 years. We expect to be in this business another 130 more plus. And to do that, it means our business grows when Michigan is prospering. Michigan can prosper when they're not putting their dollars into energy, but rather they're putting their dollars into their families and their businesses. So if we can help Michigan businesses grow and thrive, if we can help families have a more stable and prosperous future, that's good for consumers' energy in the long run. That's our long-term commitment to the people of Michigan.
I'm not hearing climate change in that.
Yeah, you know, we believe that climate change is happening. And that is why we've made this commitment. We're excited about this clean energy plan. We have a wide spectrum of people have signed on to our 20-year energy plan, including the Sierra Club and our largest business customers, because today we don't have to make what we used to think was sort of a sucker's choice. We either could have clean and expensive energy or cheap and dirty stuff. Our plan actually shows and demonstrates that we can have both clean and affordable energy. We're going to reduce our carbon emissions by 90% by 2040. We've already reduced our carbon emissions by 38% by retiring 7 of our 12 coal plants ahead of mandates, ahead of regulations. We are an energy company, and we're going to do our part to prevent climate change from being a conversation in our future.
And you're referring, of course, to the Integrated Resource Plan, your IRP, that sets that goal, 90% reduction in carbon emissions by 2040. When did you personally realize that global warming, climate change was an immediate crisis and that your company was really going to have to make some drastic changes to respond?
I'd say back in about 2015, 2016, we started to realize the impact the coal plants had and what we could do. And when I became the CEO in 2016, we really took a hard look at what was our impact and what was our position on climate change. And frankly, I used to be a bit of a denier. I had a bumper sticker that said, I heart coal. And I used to threaten to put it on my electric car just to be contrarian. And the reality is coal served Michigan and America well in its time, and it's time to transition, and technology has allowed us to transition to cleaner sources. And so my team and I really took a strong stand that we can make and lead Michigan through this transition. And climate change is the cause of our time. And I look forward to a day when my grandchildren look to me and say, Granny, what is climate change? And I get to say it's something we used to worry about.
I understand you did quite a bit of outreach to customers seeking feedback. What did you hear from them?
We continue to hear the commitment to addressing climate change. My largest business customers to my residential customers tell me all the time they want cleaner energy, and I'm excited that we've been able to do the modeling, the math, the planning, the engineering to prepare and provide that kind of clean energy future for people. They don't have to wait for a mandate. We don't have to wait for the government to sort this out. We're able to do what's right in a way that both cleans the air, reduces carbon emissions, reduces water use, reduces waste to landfill, and saves people money. The cleanest and the most affordable kilowatt is the one we never use. And that's number one on our list of next things to do, reduce the energy waste.
And these are the environmental reasons. They do feel good to kind of talk about these and focus on these. But you are the CEO of a for-profit, publicly traded energy company. Patty, how does this campaign align with what shareholders want to see, which is profit and growth? I mean, I guess, you know, there's good publicity, but what's in it for consumers to encourage customers to use less energy apart from that?
You know, I'm going to tell you, as a company and as a CEO, to your point, I have to attract billions of dollars of capital from investors and banks all across the world to fund the infrastructure here in Michigan. And I am going to tell you this, it might be surprising. CMS Energy, the company that is the parent company for Consumers Energy, the company I lead both, that CMS Energy has a higher percent of international investors because they have high ESG standards, environmental, social, and governance goals. and we pass those thresholds. And so as a U.S. utility, we're held by more international investors than any other U.S. utility because of our performance on the environment and our long-term commitments and the actions we've taken to date. Many of the other utilities don't even pass the initial threshold. I'm going to tell you, this is how our triple bottom line works. We can both serve people, planet, and prosperity and do well for all of our stakeholders by making this clean energy transition with the help of all Michiganders.
Patty, you mentioned not wanting to build new energy plants. What would your threshold be where you would say, you know what, we do have to?
Well, some people ask, why don't you retire your coal plants faster? And I'm going to tell you, we need a couple years to install our solar, to get these energy demand reduction programs up and running and validated that we can use technology to optimize air conditioning. And when we prove that to ourselves, that will help us confirm the timetable, but that's what's driving our timetable today. Mm-hmm. We're going to go as fast as we can, but we have to make sure we have reliable supply available for customers while we make that transition. And so it takes time to procure and install all the new solar that we're going to be adding, as well as optimizing demand with smart thermostats and smart energy waste reduction programs.
As you go around on this statewide tour, are you facing any skepticism? I mean, has it been a bit of a challenge to earn people's trust?
You know, what I'm excited about is people can get on board pretty quickly. Once they see our information, we share it, it answers the question, why would a utility do that? To your earlier question, why would a CEO tell people to use less of their product? Once they understand why, they get excited fast. We've asked people to start signing up for what we're calling our movement. We have a website, www.mycleanenergyplan.com. And if anyone comes to that website, we'll plant a tree in their honor. They'll be able to get information on how they can participate and be part of this movement. This is the cause of our generation, and we have an opportunity to come together, as Michiganders do so well, to absolutely change the future for our children, our children's children, and our great-great-grandchildren. This is ours to do, and no time better than the present.
Patty Poppe, CEO of Consumers Energy. Patty, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And just to note, Consumers Energy is a sponsor of Michigan Radio. We turn now to Margreta Kearney. She's a senior attorney and utility expert with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and she's based in Grand Rapids. What do you make of what Patty Poppe is saying and doing?
You know, I think that I'm seeing and hearing a lot of great things that come from Patty and from Consumers these days. The clean energy plan that Consumers has put into place is, you know, no question, a really exciting plan to see from a customer and from an environmental perspective.
Thinking of this energy demand reduction program, this campaign, put this into context for us. How common is it for a utility CEO to go around and tell customers, use less of my product?
You know, it's actually not as uncommon as you would think. And the reason for that is that we've done a pretty good job here in Michigan, and other states have done a good job with this as well, of putting into place some incentives that make utilities want to do this. So early on, folks realized that energy efficiency and saving energy is a good thing, and it's a good thing for customers, but it wasn't something that companies really wanted to do because they didn't make any money off of it. And so we put into place incentives that basically allow utility companies to recover the costs of these energy waste reduction programs and to earn some money on them. Now, they're not earning as much money as if they'd built a giant plant, but they are earning money off those programs, and so that's why it's still an attractive option for companies and for their investors.
But just considering that this is a for-profit, publicly traded company, is there more financial incentive for consumers to follow this path?
Well, I think that there is a sufficient financial incentive for this to follow the path, or for consumers to follow this path. And there's also the fact that I think one thing that the company really seems to be recognizing is that there is a change afoot. And not all utilities are quite as far ahead in recognizing this, that the way utilities provide energy in this country is changing. The way they provide it in Michigan is changing. And it's moving much more towards energy efficiency and what the tools we can use to reduce energy use and to use energy more efficiently without sacrificing comfort, without sacrificing reliability. Also moving to renewable energy, more distributed energy. This is the way things are going, and I do applaud consumers for seeing this and for making an early move in that direction.
Margareta, how much of this could be seen as greenwashing? I mean, they're offering to plant a tree for every person who, you know, checks out the website and signs up for one thing or another. Could one view this as a kind of a basic run play up the middle out of the old greenwashing playbook?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a concern when you see things like that. I'm a consumer's customer, so I also get, you know, the things that they send out in the mail, and I see all this stuff. You know, I am cautiously optimistic about this. I really think that from the company in the past few years, there has been somewhat of a cultural shift where the effort is to listen to what customers are asking for, to work with customers to put together programs that are helpful, that are useful, that represent the way they want to see clean and affordable energy delivered. So I'm looking at this, and I also think you look at, you know, the CEO going around and sharing that message with customers, with constituents. I think that that does show a level of commitment that right now I look at and I'm willing to say, all right, they seem to be, you know, really all in on this idea.
Just broadly speaking, why should we trust consumers or any utility company to be truly responsible actors when it comes to climate change?
Well, I think that we probably shouldn't trust fully anyone. There are a lot of great things we hear about climate change. And, yeah, I really hope that when my grandkids ask me, you know, what was climate change, I can tell them it's something that we fixed or that we reversed. But what I can tell you is that the current plans we have in place right now are not going to get us there, even with these kinds of promises from consumers, from other utilities. We really do need to be doing more. We need to be working faster. So while it's encouraging to hear that now this is part of the conversation, how can we address climate change, we really need to be pushing things faster and we need to be pushing things further. And I don't think we can sit back and say, oh, hey, they care about climate change, so we're all good. We don't need to worry about it. We still need to be out there pushing for as much as can be done, as soon as can be done.
What could happen if this energy demand reduction effort falls short, if business customers or residential customers don't hit those goals that help consumers hit that goal of reducing usage and also reducing carbon emissions by 2040?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I do want to push back a little on the idea that without those reductions, there's a need to build 3 new gas plants. You know, the hope is we never get to that we see these types of reductions. We have not in Michigan, it's very clear that we have not hit, you know, all of the reductions that we can. There is a lot to be gained out there from some of these energy waste reduction strategies. But I do think that even if that target isn't fully hit, that does not mean that we necessarily need to build 3 new gas plants. There are all sorts of options in Michigan that we haven't pursued enough: storage, solar, using wind in an efficient way. So I do think that I want to push back on that idea a little bit, but it shouldn't dissuade people. People shouldn't feel like, oh, well, we'll find another solution. I do think that folks should really be attentive to these programs, because at the end of the day, you can save a lot of money by engaging in these programs. So people really should take a look and figure out, hey, is there something I can do here that doesn't change my quality of living, the way my business performs, but will save me some money?
So as a utility expert with the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and as you said, a consumer's customer, what are you going to be watching for going forward?
I'm going to be watching for the consistency in this messaging and kind of this long game. Over the next couple of years, what I'm going to be watching for is whether the company is able to be adaptable and to pivot depending on what they're hearing from customers, what they're seeing in terms of signups for programs. Sometimes utilities design programs that frankly just aren't all that good because, you know, they're not customers. They don't always understand what may be preventing a customer from using a program. So I'm going to be looking for that kind of responsiveness and adaptation. And I'm going to be looking for the company to make good on the renewable energy build-out, to hold competitive solicitations, to start siting projects, and to, you know, really get shovels in the ground so that they can get those coal plants offline as soon as possible.
Margreta Kearney, senior attorney and utility expert with the Environmental Law and Policy Center. She's based in Grand Rapids, and we want to thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And tomorrow on Stateside, we'll explore how desegregation efforts in Grand Rapids schools are working. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.